Good afternoon. I'm so happy to see everyone here and thank you for lying with us and cooperating as I said earlier, thinking through how rooms that we're in facilitate different sorts of discussion, how our body proximity blocks or facilitates language and energy exchange. So we're going to do things a little differently today, but I do want to do some form of it. I want to remind you that you are now, just like on the airplane, if you're here for decolonizing methodologies, then you are on the right flight. And we are so thrilled to have here with us today three scholars that when the Planning Committee began talking about who we'd like to have, even though people's schedules are really mad and people are really in demand, et cetera, we decided that we would like to have three scholars. And we went forward and asked them, and lo and behold, they said yes. And we still held our breath and said, well, things happen. Things happen, people's schedules, et cetera. But what happened is that these three stellar people and scholars and activists have arrived here and have entered into a conversation together and with us. So we have for you today Chela Sandoval from the University of California at Santa Barbara. From the University of Auckland in New Zealand. And M. Jackie Alexander from the University of Toronto. Before we begin, I would like to pass out these cards. I'd like you to take one and pass them along. I'm also going to pass out some pencils for those of you who don't have many who have pens already. And I have a problem with partner when you use those pencils. And we'll tell you a little later what to do with those, what we're going to do with those cards. So the way it's going to go is that each one of the panelists will give some very brief words of introduction, and then we'll have a discussion around a couple of particular points of convergence. After which, depending upon how that goes, we may have another sort of round of summing up by all three panelists, and then we'll take a break. After the break, we'll do something else very, very exciting. I didn't introduce myself. My name is Jabari Sinclair Allen. I'm with the Center for African and African American Studies and Department of Anthropology. Thank you very much. My job is to sit here and to bask, so I won't be interrupted with the
I have one other quick instruction about the three of five cards. We met last night and wanted to share this exercise with you. It's an exercise developed by many of you, I developed the same exercise as I found by going to your workshops in Harold's and I think it's being generated out of those who call themselves performance activists. But before the lawyer and Abdul Adad, we began to talk about what we called at that time the shaman witness ritual. And the shaman, and then I'm now beginning to call the Napa witness ritual. Gloria wrote about this ritual, and this is a quote from one of her writings, that the ability of story to transform the storyteller and the listener into something or someone else is shamanistic. The performer, as shape changer, is Napa, she said, a shaman. So what we're experimenting with here is the way in which our stories, the stories that we will tell today on this panel, are transformative not only They are transformative of us as we speak, but they'll also be transformative of you as you listen, as you become active witnesses to what we're performing here. What we'd like you to do in this shaman witness ritual is we'd like you on that 3x5 card to write down,
and actually, you'll probably need more than 3x5 card because it's going to take so long, but here's how we do it. You write down one word that moves you in today's duration, or one word, or one idea, or one concept that moves you or strikes you during today's conversation. And at the end of today's ritual, we'll ask that each of you take your place as transformer, as storyteller, as active witness by giving us back, giving the group, giving this collective that's beginning to form, the word, or the idea, or the concept, and we ask you not take more than 30 seconds if it's more than one word, or if it's a concept or idea, so that everyone can put their voice out into the collective. And that's how we'd like to end. We'd like to end by us being as transformed by your words, your perceptions, your ideas. And the way we get transformed is by you giving us the word that mattered to you. So you have to track what's going on inside of you as we're giving what we have to give to you today. And that is how, when you give it back to us, we will be transformed, or the group, or the community will be transformed. So that's the lesson that Gloria Zalpil was working on before she passed, and we wanted to share that with you as the exercise around these 3x5 cards. Thank you.
Tēnā koutou katoa, in my own language, greetings to all of you who have gathered here this morning. Greetings to the land that we are situated on, and an acknowledgement of the stories, the journeys, and the peoples whose lives have been written in this landscape. And so greetings from my people and my land to this land, and to the people who are here before us, and to those of you who are here today. Apologies to this group here for my back. I hope that I can keep turning enough times that you don't feel I'm not talking to you. I'm an Indigenous person from New Zealand. We have a population of 4 million, and that's the New Zealand population. And there are about 500,000 Indigenous people. There are 7 universities, and there are only 4 Māori women who are professors in our institutions. And that comes with a few responsibilities and many issues, which I might get to later on. I have a sort of multidisciplinary background with a I grew up in a family of an anthropologist, a native anthropologist, who was an art historian as well. I studied history. I gave that the flick at the end of the first degree. I then studied psychology. That didn't do it for me. I discovered critical sociology on the way to a psychology class. And that seemed to satisfy my needs at that time, but I've never been able to locate myself in a single discipline. And I struggle with disciplines all the time. And that makes me a slightly undisciplined academic. But we'll talk later about how we came to be in this particular space and produce the work that we have done. I just really want to acknowledge those of you who are here, and acknowledge those of you whose first language is not English. I know that, you know, it takes time for people to get used to my New Zealand accent. We swallow the ends of our words, but I hope you'll get into the rhythm of it, and, you know, and it's a New Zealand accent, not an Australian one. You'll get used to it. So, greetings, everyone.
Chela Sandoval. I'm here from California, by way of New Mexico. First, I want to acknowledge the organizers of this conference who, through sheer determination and continuing to email me, regardless of how many times I didn't respond, but never gave up, in order to bring us here. And you all know about that kind of determination, because it's through that kind of determination that many of you are here at the university. And certainly it's through that determination that we here are present before you today. I have learned from most of you during the 3 days of this conference. And I've learned from all of you who have traveled so far to be with us here today. I have traveled here from all over the world. And so those of you who have come to this hemisphere or into this country to work with us and think with us, I welcome you and thank you for coming. What we've come here for is to talk about how to create new forms of knowledge within this knowledge industry, within these knowledge institutions. And what I've learned is that there are many of us here in this room who are working to do such a thing. In that strain, I'd like to thank the organizers again for bringing me here to be sitting at this table with these two women, because these people, these two women, have had the courage to speak out of non-disciplined spaces in order to create the space for the subaltern to speak and to be heard, and for those voices to transform the way in which human beings think and the ways in which human beings create knowledge. And so I'm honored to be sitting here with the two of you, and one of the reasons I came was to be able to sit here at this table with you.
It's just a very sort of palpable, what's the feeling in this room is just very palpable. I'm Jackie Alexander, and I don't know, there's a way in which I think being here is such a metaphor for so many journeys that we undertake and multiple crossings, and the fact that we have to cross over and over again, and that crossings are never complete. We always have to do them again and again and again. So we are here, all of us, each of us in this room, out of the multiple crossings and journeys we have taken in our individual and collective lives. And so in a deep sense, I'm really grateful to the organizers of the conference for bringing us together. I mean, we could just never take for granted the kinds of guerrilla spaces that get opened up, especially during a time of utter repression and fascism. So I'm deeply grateful for that commitment, for the continued emails and in the midst of the lack of responses, Taylor says. And just our individual determination to be committed to the kind of transformation that makes it possible for us never to settle for what hegemonic discourse would prompt us to settle for. So I'm grateful for the individual journeys that each of you has taken to bring you here at this time, in this place, at this moment. I'm very grateful for this table, this round table, this round room. Grateful for Chela and the work that she has done. Grateful for Linda and the work that she has done, to Jafari and to each of you. Even if I haven't, quote unquote, read from you, I feel palpably your presence here this morning. At yesterday's discussion, I said that there is something that's feeling familiar to me here. Familiar. There's a familiarity. And I think that familiarity is borne out by the journeys that we have taken and crossed the paths that we have crossed. I'm also grateful to our ancestors
who have brought me actually to this particular path in my life that makes it possible for me even to speak. So I ask their permission to speak this morning.
I wanted to begin the conversation by asking, and each of you has talked a bit about your journeys and crossings, and to simply ask you, how did you get here? Each of you, how did you get to this moment, this place?
It's like not a deliberately planned journey. I just got here. You know, both metaphorically and physically, in terms of the miles that I've travelled to get here, it's a long and sometimes tortuous and painful journey, and sometimes a joyous journey. If you ask me how did I get to produce a piece of work called Decolonizing Methodologies, I could ground a journey in something quite specific that I produced. And that really takes me back to a sort of, I do write about it in the first chapter of the book, a sort of a tradition of activism in my own family. And so to me it was kind of natural to be thinking about decolonization and to be critiquing colonialism and the colonization of my people. And so that was my kind of roots in terms of my own education at home. And at the same time, I came out of a valley. If you've ever lived in a valley, it has certain kind of constraints. But echoes are really good in a valley, you know, so you can sort of shout out and it sort of comes back. And when I wrote Decolonizing Methodologies, I thought, you know, here am I down under in a little country and I'm just going to put this out there and see what comes back. And at the time, I didn't think it was particularly radical. All I thought I was doing was bringing together and putting down into words on a piece of paper what I'd grown up hearing and trying to make sense of that. You know, everywhere we'd gone, it's like, we are the most researched people in the world. And I've heard that all around the world. You know, and it became quite sort of interesting to me when I started to study about why would people feel like that? And how do you feel that you've been researched and that you're the most researched? What does that feel like? And how do you come to understand that? And at the time when I was writing, honestly, there was no one, even in my own colleagues, who could understand why I would be interested in research, in researching research. Everyone was trying to do it. And I couldn't even begin to do it because I didn't understand what was being asked of me as a graduate student. And so that's the beginning of, sort of the beginning, it's one beginning of my journey here. And then you feel like a little voice shouting out, putting it out there and hoping that some echoes come back. And in a way, this is a little bit like an echo. It's come back to me. And what I love about it is I get to meet others here beside me and here in front of me who are working in similar spaces, trying to do similar things. And they're, you know, the work kind of resonates maybe with what I was doing, but unfortunately I was kind of blissfully and naively unaware of so many of the struggles that academics and communities around the world have been conducting and waging over generations and over centuries. And I tried to describe a particular set of struggles and spaces from the Indigenous context from which I come. It doesn't necessarily speak well to other contexts, but often, you know, there's something that someone finds and something in Britain and it kind of unlocks something for them. And if it does that, I think it's kind of useful. If it sits on a shelf, then to me, it's not really what I aspired it to be. I want it to be like a bestseller in a trade aid shop. That really was my aspiration, because it was the first really book I'd published. And I remember walking along the library. No one told me how you get published. So I went to the library in our university and I looked at all the books I liked. And I looked at who the publishers were. So I wrote a list. I started at the top with Z Books in London. And I thought, right, I'm going to write to them. So I wrote a letter. I drafted out chapter headings. And I gave them an example of my writing. And then I was just going to work my way down that list. So I sent it off to them by email. And within a week, I had got a response back. Don't send this to any other publishers. We are interested in it. What kind of time frame would you like to work with? And in a way, that's a kind of lucky break, isn't it, for those people who have published. You usually get sort of a few rejections on the way.
That's right.
So off I sailed and set myself a time frame and then pulled together that work. And argued about the title, argued about the cover, worried all the time about whether I was making sense to anyone other than myself. And in the end, you know, you let things go. You just let it go and wait for the feedback. And that's what I did. But I think the book slept for 2 years. You know, just went out there and I carried on doing other things. And really it was published in 1999. And it then started to pick up. And the fiercest criticisms of my book are from within my own country and from within scholars who oppose Foucault, Edward Said, postmodernism, post-structuralism, changes in the academy, indigenous rights movements. So those sorts of positions are ones that were already lined up to critique the book. And really that's kind of, it opened a door for me that enabled me to be here. But in order to walk through that door, I think you have to do other things as well. And we can talk about that later.
I'm very curious about what the next piece of this is going to be. But the question that we're answering is what got us here. I was sent here. I was sent here in 1969. I was sent here through the forces of all of the decolonial struggles of the 20th century. In high school, I was summoned by my people, and the summon went like this, at least this is how I remember it. They have not let us into the universities. You have to go. All of you have to go. Well, we were a ragtag group of kids and child care center workers, working with Julian Camacho in San Jose, California. And we didn't know what it meant to go to the university. We didn't know the difference between a junior college and a state college. We didn't know what the difference between a state college was and Stanford University. Most of us were smart, but we were not trained, couldn't write, never went to school. A lot of us were in and out of continuation school for not showing up. Grown up mostly without lunches, without food, without breakfast, without clothes. We were poor. Didn't have training, any mathematical training or writing training. And we thought, how can we go to college? And what we were told by a bunch of college kids who thought of themselves as third world liberationists, we were told, it doesn't matter you don't know how to do any of that, because, and this is what I knew was true, our people know things, we have access to knowledges that they don't know about, and you all have to go into the university and bring those knowledges into that structure. And so we felt that that was our mission, and we had faith that we knew what our communities knew about survival, about going to an emergency room and not being treated because we were obviously, we were Mexican, we were members of the colonized class, that the Anglos would be treated first. We knew what it meant to survive in spite of those material conditions. We knew what it meant to survive in spite of not having food, and we survived inside of the educational institutions. We were developing methodologies of the oppressed. Now, somebody told me once that the oppressed, there is no methodology of the oppressed. The oppressed will do anything they have to do in order to survive. But what if that truth were raised to a higher level of ethical and moral positioning? And that was what I was able to begin discovering with friends who had experienced similar life experiences later on in the 70s, Third World Feminist. But I was sent here. I had a mission. We had a mission. Our mission was to bring our knowledges into the institution. And in order to do that, we had to do a lot of work. And I don't know that I'm going to tell you about that work now, but to answer the question of how I got here, I was sent on a mission. I took it seriously. And it culminated in the methodology of the oppressed.
This mission thing is no joke, you know? I mean, it's, right? I mean, it's no joke, this idea of, I mean, Linda, you put it in terms of, you know, making sense of what you had grown up with, making sense of what you knew to be legitimate in a very profound sense, and Chima, this whole idea of being sent on a mission, but that you had knowledge that was different than what the dominant knowledge paradigm was, but that you had that knowledge. And it's making me sort of think back in the context of the Caribbean, in Trinidad in particular, where I grew up, sort of on the cusp of anti-colonial struggle, a nationalist movement in the Caribbean, sort of reflective of a time that, you know, movements had already begun in India, movements had already begun on the continent, on the African continent, that is. And really learning for the first time in a particular kind of way what subjectivity might mean. And I want to introduce the might mean, because I think that there was a way in which anti-colonial movements at the time didn't take care of a certain dimension of identity, a certain dimension of identity politics, which I then later learned through feminism and through women of color feminism and lesbian feminist consciousness. But we'll get to that part of the story. We'll just bracket that for the moment. But it was the idea that one could have subjectivity, that one could have a subjectivity that was different than being thought about or being thinking about oneself as either the one who is researched or the one who is looked down upon or the one who did not have anything to contribute. So education was a mandate. It was a mandate. It was a political mandate. It was a political mandate that one could learn certain things to be the basis of transformation. And I think in a very fundamental way, that's what's reconciling or bringing us, the three of us, to that, you know, very specific intersection, you know, why it is or how it is decolonization sort of comes to be, right, the place where at least we partially sit. And we sit partially in that place because of the histories of colonization, right, because of the histories of colonization. So in a very fundamental sense, those of my generation in the Caribbean believed in a certain kind of nationalism. We believed in the power of transformation. I mean, we believed that we could kick Britain out, We believed that. And we also believed something which ended up being a fallacy, which is what made me take the trajectory in my work, which was every creed and race had an equal place. Or out of many one. All the nationalist symbols that we grew up singing and believing very deeply, actually. You know, we believed in a very fundamental sense. And I think that what my work, where my work begins to take off is the breach of that promise. Is at the breach of that promise, is at the very point when that promise only has ideological significance to generate a particular kind of citizens or a particular kind of woman or a particular kind of man. It has ideological significance. But the promise becomes, what's the word? Just kind of taken back, held back on. But not only held back on, but it's almost as though the state now comes in to tell you, I never promised you that. Or if I did, you were foolish enough to believe it. And so it's the point of that betrayal then, in a very fundamental sense, the point of that betrayal that then starts me off on a whole bunch of investigations in which sexuality becomes the core or the idea that I'm trying to understand in relationship to identity formation. So, I mean, we'll talk in more detail about our work. And just to remember, just even the question of how you got here, that memory is itself faulty. And so there's a lot that we are leaving out in this narration. So even this narration of how we got here is a contingent one. But it doesn't mean that it's false.
I just wanted to add something. Which is, while you were speaking, it reminded me of a quote by Foucault, which I now can't remember, but the last part of it is, the challenge of the 21st century is for us to transform what we have become. And I think that Fanon said the same thing in the right places, that to be shaped into a colonial subject is to be shaped into a subject who is self-denigrating. And the decolonial struggle, in part, that U.S. liberal feminism was about in the 70s, was about looking at the way in which subjectivity, one's subjectivity, needed to be transformed in order, the hope that so many of these decolonial writers you find in the third world feminist writings is about reconstituting the self out of the colonial messages and creating new forms of collectivity, because this is not simply an individual issue.
Last night when we were talking, we talked about the readings along the way, and maybe we should recover that. What it is we read to get to where we are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do.
Yeah. Oh, you want me to say?
Yeah.
You know, you ask us. Oh, what did you read to get to this space? What did you read in the official curriculum?
Yeah.
And what did you read in the unofficial curriculum that made a difference and that enabled you to begin your intellectual journey?
Yeah.
So,
we were shocked because we all read the same things, but starting in 1969.
Yeah. Yeah, we all read the same things. And that's no coincidence, no? It's no coincidence that we did. But just before I come to talking about we read. I just want to make one little comment on the end of the last conversation about what this whole, what seems to be this apparent contradiction between working for movements for change as an outside, as a thing outside oneself, in relationship to the mandate of transforming the self through doing that kind of work. And I think that perhaps in a way, the more inherited struggles for decolonization, in large part, focused much more heavily on the transformation of outside political institutions, yes. As if we were not ourselves implicated in those very structures.
Absolutely.
And so the point of demarcation, I think, in the 70s and 80s with third world feminism really is a point of demarcation around transformation of the self. But a self that is not necessarily only an individuated self, a sort of collectivized self, but a self that understands these internal traces, you know, which of course Fanon himself talks about. And Fanon is actually one of the writers that we all read, because Fanon himself talks about it in Black Skins, White Masks. I mean, that's precisely how that formulation comes about, right? The notion of the quote-unquote oppressor within, right? That later within the context of feminism, we come to understand as internalized oppression, or even Du Bois understood it in terms of double consciousness, right? It treading on the same vise, in a sense, right? To come to some kind of understanding about how is this subjectivity constituted, which is a complicated thing, which is one of the things we were saying last night, is why the work of decolonization is just constant. It's just constant. So one of the things we read was final.
It wasn't just what we read, it's what we all didn't read. For me, the late 60s, early 70s, in New Zealand, it was a time of civil unrest. There was feminism and gay liberation and the anti-Vietnam War and the South African rugby tours to New Zealand. It was a heady and messy time to learn about politics, and probably one of the best times if you're growing up to learn about your own country. And I know that, I joined one of the Indigenous activist groups, and we never read feminism. And partly because we couldn't really get to it, but the other part was we always felt like we were renting space inside it. It didn't really speak to us until we found the voices of other Indigenous women and African American women and women of the third world. But that took a while for, text to get to, get translated often into the English language, like Fanon took a while, and then into New Zealand. So there was this whole alternative reading that we would do alongside what it was we happened to be studying. But after last night, I went home and thought, what text in my entire undergraduate degree do I remember was powerful? And it was actually St. Augustine's City of God. Now, the reason it was powerful was actually not the book itself, but I had one of the best teachers in that class that I'd ever experienced in my entire undergraduate course. And I never read City of God until just before the exam. But I read, really through his teachings, and he was a scholar from Cambridge who believed in the tutorial system. So he never really gave a lecture. He just talked to us, and he would set us tasks. And, of course, we'd go, we'll do it the night before class. But along the way, we just explored all these important ideas. And when I came to read City of God, at the end of the course, driven, of course, by an exam, I really loved it. And I just kind of went through it. It was like I had to spend that entire time in preparation to read The City of God. And it's, last night was the only text I could remember from my entire undergraduate degree. And this morning, it is still the only text that I remember. And I think it was the power of that teacher. And he, what he did was related it to our lives. He forced us to relate things to our lives. And no one else who taught me did that. You know, forced me to kind of confront and think about my own life. It was all distant. I mean, I majored in history. And in the 1970s in New Zealand, there was no New Zealand history paper. You majored in Renaissance history or medieval history. And at first, you know, I, like my other students, we raged against that. So they put in a course on New Zealand history, and it was so awful. It was, you know, it's like having your history told by someone who didn't think you were there. You're not present in that landscape, in that story. So it was worse. So I majored in medieval history and thought, well, okay, I'm just going to have to learn about all these white people. And ultimately it will become useful.
When you talk about what we learn as undergraduates, and it's hard for us to remember the main text that we were asked to read. And it reminds me of the ways in which teaching and learning in the institution really pushes us to the surface of being and experience and perception, rather than enables us to connect with what's happening in our lives, our communities, our and in fact, as a professor, I'm in order to be evaluated every 2 years, the number of publications are counted, and no credence is given to the depth or the profundity of what one is trying to deal with. You don't get promoted unless you have the numbers. It doesn't matter. So people get good at generating the numbers at a superficial level. That's what our institution, our knowledge institutions, are doing to us. So what you're saying reminds me of this, that, I wanted to say something else. And now I don't remember what it is. I know what I want to say. It's about, what you made me remember is the first radical text I remember was, it was when I was in high school. It was during a group of us, you know, it was during the time of the Vietnam War. And I joined a study group in which we read Ho Chi Minh, The Little Red Book. We read it in a little collective of people. And it was when I first became aware that people in other countries were trying to deal with struggles of decolonization, of revolution, a cultural revolution that would transform us as human beings, and it meant that we would relate to each other differently on a collective level, on a collaborative level, and as individuals. And I felt such excitement and hope about that, as did a lot of us at that time. And then from there, I went to, I did mention Ho Chi Minh. So, and then from there, we read, what was that? The first chapter of Capital. All three of us. Das Kapital. I mean, we had to hand write it. I had to hand write the whole thing. I could read it. I didn't understand it. So I didn't understand it. Something that I wrote it by my hand and read my own handwriting. I could get it. And then from there, it was Ame Cesare. In the first third world feminist study group I was in 1972, which Barbara Noda was in, she writes about it. It was a short piece called Low Riding Through the Women's Movement in This Bridge Called My Back. And she talks about that first study group. You guys remember that piece? And I'm glad that she documents it there, because we were all in our you know, early 20s, and it was the first third world women's group that we knew about, and we began to make connections with other third world women's groups in the Bay Area. That I was in San Jose and Santa Cruz, but now we were reaching out to San Francisco and Berkeley, and we found that there were third world women's groups emerging all over the country. We began to make contact with, but we read Aimé Césaire, and we went to, and we demonstrated again, and the group of us went to Nixon had flown into town, and we went, and Sharon Liu stood up against the cyclone fence, and I forgot what she was saying, something about Reagan, and the audience, the people there started saying, go back to where you come from, you know, she was Chinese. Go home, and there were, I think, four of us there. We stood in a little circle around her as she stood against the cyclone fence, because there was such animosity directed toward her. This was, you know, an experience that we had, all of us, in our, I don't know, 21, 22 years old. Then we read Fanon, and this is something that we all have in common, our trajectory of reading. And then where did we go? I forgot.
And then this we bring up. Yeah, it was crucial. But I think part of what's emerging for us in talking about what we've read is that, and the different movements of which we were a part. I mean, the companion things happening at the same time. Because I never came to feminism through mainstream white feminism. So it's a phenomenal formation, I think, and an important formation, not to understand feminism through white mainstream metropolitan feminism. So my formation through feminism was actually through feminist movement in the Caribbean, and it's important to say that, you know, because quote-unquote third world is usually looked upon as not places where any kind of progressive politics happens. So there's no feminism in the Caribbean, there's no lesbian and gay people in the Caribbean, there are no lesbian feminist movements in the Caribbean, etc. Only places of tourism, not places of knowledge formation. Let me breathe right there. I didn't mean to just kind of go there, you know, but sometimes you just have to. So there was that, and also the emergence of women of color feminism in the United States was extremely formative for me. To come to understand what women of color consciousness means, that's different actually, though related to black consciousness, but a woman of color consciousness really is speaking about the fluency that we have and can cultivate in each other's histories, right? And that being a task, that being a mandate, that being a mission, the fluency that we can cultivate in each other's histories. And one of the reasons that was really important for me, and that was triggered for me also, Linda, by something that you said, is that, you know, in high school in the Caribbean, you paid a price for being a quote-unquote smart student. And the price that you pay for being a smart student is that you were not allowed to learn Caribbean history. It's too deep. The level of colonization is just so deep. So the message is that you need not learn about yourself. You need not learn about yourself. So you learn about Europe. So I knew all about European history. I knew American geography. I knew everything about the Grand Canyon. I knew about the geishas. I knew about how to get hydroelectric power in Canada. I mean, I remember going to the St. Lawrence, Seaway. And it took us 3 hours to go through the hydroelectric plant. And I remember saying, my God, it took us a whole damn semester to learn this blooming thing. And here you could walk through this thing in 3 hours and knew how it functioned. I mean, but that was the nature of colonization. And in a sense, what we were being cultivated to rule. Mm-hmm. So as members of the ruling class, that's why the neocolonial class is so bankrupt. Okay. Yeah. You see, that's why I don't want to be taped. Because, you know, learning to inherit a kind of class status meant that you had to inherit a global, the consciousness of a global ruling class, and not of your own people, and not of your own people. So the conscious decisions then later on, although I grew up in a family that was politicized, my father being a member of the Socialist Party, etc., at the time of nationalism, so that political consciousness was cultivated at home. So the conscious going after particular texts, particular communities, building later, joining particular movements was a decision, right? A conscious decision about how to relearn oneself, you know, away from the very dominant models that one had been really being cultivated to learn, right? So you're being cultivated to live your own alienation in a profound sense.
And this is such a conflict. One of the challenges to my work is that is made in this way. You say that subjectivity can be transformed, that you are not being loyal to our people and the truth of their identities. And what is getting missed there is this point here, that in order to decolonize the self from whatever position we come at it from, it takes the ability to read one's own set of signs, internal signs, and see where those signs are placing us in relation to power and in relation to one another. And sometimes those figurations have got to be transformed, and the very reconstitution of subjectivity will be demanded of us. And to do that in collective and collaboration with others is the hope and the dream that third world liberation made possible, that great global movement of the 50s and 60s that united at that time peoples of color from all nation states all over the world and made those of us in the United States feel that we were part of a global movement that would unite citizen subjects everywhere into citizen warriors, into a new kind of international global citizenship, the psychic, a new psychic terrain that would unite us across hemispheres. And that was the great hope of third world liberation, which in part is what motivated and energized U.S. third world feminism and the kind of consciousness that was then elaborated by the U.S. third world feminists who did that elaboration in the 70s and 80s, talking about Gloria Anselm and others I know very well.
I think I grew up in when you grow up in a valley, you're isolated. And I remember going home from university and talking about what I'd been learning, what I'd been thinking with my cousins and aunts and uncles, and they were going like, how do you say we're colonized? We're not colonized. Yeah. Who's colonizing us? Yeah. It's like they never really saw it. And don't bring those fancy ideas home from university. Like, get back in the kitchen, wash dishes, and, you know, learn how to do that properly. I really did come out of a set of communities who, because we were isolated, and because, you know, most of my family weren't living in urban settings, really didn't see the impact in their own lives of, of colonization and of a relationship of power where we didn't get to make, you know, key decisions about our lives. And yet at the same time, it was a very political family, because we would sit around at dinner and we would talk about a piece of legislation which was going to take away just a little bit more of our land. And, you know, one powerful moment for me was an act called the Wastelands Act, which was to deal with indigenous farmers and people who owned land who grew weeds. You know, like our land wasn't in productive use. We weren't using it for sheep and cattle and gardens. It was just there. And so they brought in this Wastelands Act. And if you didn't you know, turn your land into productive use, the government could take your land. And I remember, you know, the debates around our extended family about how unjust that act was, you know, that we were forced to turn our land into this kind of farm, you know, into farming all the time, when it just went against our whole philosophy of land. So, you know, while at one point it wasn't political and people wanted to deny politics and not speak it, at the other end of it, things that mattered to them, they would talk about it all the time. And we're very, you know, we always had the, you know, the term bush lawyers. I mean, we had a family of bush lawyers, bush doctors, you know, bush experts and everything. And it was this constant engagement with what really mattered to our family and our valley. But at the same time, there were other things happening that you didn't know until you went out of your valley. Like, you weren't conscious that the language was being lost. You weren't conscious of the damage being done to children. You know, I remember the big deal when one of my cousins was put into, became a state ward. And because they had moved into the city and she was made a state ward, and everyone at home was going, you know, like, what's the state ward? What does the state do? And how, you know, at first the anger was turned on my aunt. How dare she fail as a mother to be looking after her child? It's your, you know, your first duty as a mother. How dare you fail? And so there were debates. The government's good because it's going to look after her, and the government's bad because, you know, they've taken our child away. So you grow up with these kind of political arguments, but you never get to put them together. It's kind of life. It's a life you live until you start to think of that bigger picture, whether it's colonization or globalization or racism. You know, you learn this language. You learn a language for trying to talk about your experience. If you don't have that language, if you don't have those tools, then, you know, you're talking about isolated incidents that piss you off.
Yeah,
it's just constant sort of anger until you get some tools to really put it all together. And I think that's what I got ultimately. But it's like those, we constantly need either to brush up our tools or new tools.
You had a nice metaphor for that last night, Jay. You were talking about how much of our work has been the work of gathering. Mm-hmm. Do you remember?
Assembly.
Yeah, Jayla was saying last night, just sort of on to this point that Linda just made, that but one of the things that she has found in all of our work was this way in which we are gathering from different places, different locations, different epistemologies, different disciplines, different histories, and being engaged in some kind of continual act of renaming. So that, for instance, in your work, Jayla, you have this very specific formulation of differential consciousness. What does it mean for US women of color to have, right, or oppositional consciousness? And so that came after you were in fact assembling and culling from all the work that the world feminists have done.
Oh, I remember that. Mm-hmm. And it's what the point is that I think what our point here was, I think you both agreed with me, that we are not exceptional voices, that our mission meant that we were placed at the university to cull, to assemble, to pay attention to the voices of our people, and to translate, to articulate those, to bring those voices into the academy and to make them recognized as official contributions to human knowledge. And so the whole term oppositional consciousness, that wasn't my invention. It was everyone in this 50s, 60s, 70s, was saying, we have a form of oppositional consciousness. And I said, well, what is it? What form is it? Well, it turns out there's all kinds of forms of oppositional consciousness, and we can talk about what they are and what they look like. And that U.S. third world feminists of the 70s deployed a particular form of oppositional consciousness that I call differential. But what we are doing is not creating something new or novel out of experience. We are people who, all three of us, who were placed in a position that enabled us to name what was happening for our people. And for some reason, we each had the courage to be able to make the naming. What do you call it? What do third world feminists say? I don't know. I'll call it differential because they can differentiate. I mean, I'll name it. You know, what's the structure that I'm devising here? I'm going to name it methodology of the oppressed. Nobody else has named it. Let's name it and put it into play and see how it circulates in the university. Well, we thought at some point it was going to change the university and that we would create an interdisciplinary knowledge system, but I don't know that that's going to happen in my lifetime. Mm-hmm.
But the fact that we have done this work doesn't make us special. Because this task of making our experiences intelligible is something that's actually given to everybody. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To everybody. And that's precisely why we can have a conference at the confluence of quote-unquote activist and academic scholarship. And that's why I like, what's her name, who has this formulation I'm going to forget what I'm wanting to say. She's at Stanford, who's done this work sort of talking about the scholarship that comes out of the community as scholarship and not as at the University of Toronto. This distinction that folks make is that it's almost as though the academy has knowledge but the community has community. Mm-hmm. So the links between academics and the community is called Knowledge Community Alliance, right? So the academy has knowledge but the community has community. It is true that in the academy there isn't a lot of community. I mean, but you know, sort of how we think about the kinds of knowledges that get generated in multiple sites becomes extremely important, so that we do not reify this distinction between quote unquote this scholarly production that takes place. The academy is only one site. It's only one site where knowledge production happens. I mean, that's why, Chela, you can speak about the fact that, you know, your people said to you, you are to go and impart this knowledge that is not there, right? So, and also to mark the fact that I think in my own work, none of the work would have taken the shape that it had in the absence of political movements that already outlined and threw up the very categories that were then available for a different kind of analysis. Yeah? So I'm not meaning to say that all sites are the same, but all the sites generate knowledge. All the sites generate knowledge. And the question is, what kind of attention do we bring, depending on where you are located, to those quote-unquote differential sites? So it's better to think about our capacity to make the world intelligible and to make our experience intelligible as an existential capacity rather than a class capacity or a color capacity or geographically bound capacity.
Activist scholars, to be an activist scholar means that you will be speaking much of the time from the outside of the disciplinary categories that will legitimate you in the academy. And it will take strength and courage to step forward and keep renaming. And where does that come from? I think of Gloria, who moved to Santa Cruz, Gloria Anzaldo, who moved to Santa Cruz and applied to a PhD program and was told, that her work wasn't academic enough, it wasn't scholarly enough for her to be accepted in this program. And yet this work has had such intense impact across disciplines and scholarly disciplines, from, you know, from English departments to anthropology departments, even science, varying kinds of biology departments, at Will Fortmore and Zellville. This is an example of this kind of guerrilla knowledge system breaking apart the disciplines from within and creating new modes or nodes for human knowledge to get generated. That's in part what all these three of these books have tried to do, and it's such a miracle that you all have invited us here to be together, because we recognize in each other's work the same impulse, the same kind of attention and loyalty to an internal commitment to speak that and to name that which has been made voiceless wherever we're looking, whether it's at whatever text we happen to be looking at. And that's what I see in terms of the similarities.
Well, just before we finish or take a break, I agree that knowledge is generated in many sites, but we get paid to produce it. In the academy, and I think that makes a big difference in all kinds of ways. Some of which, when you're sort of driven and paid and rewarded for producing knowledge, it doesn't necessarily mean you're producing great knowledge. You're just producing, and more production, adds up to kind of more brownie points at the end. So I think that the challenge always, certainly from the position I come from, is the negotiation with your own communities of interest that you work with to, I guess, have multiple trade-offs. Mm-hmm. So they give you permission to produce because you need that in your environment. And you produce things that are going to be make a difference in their environment, and you give time to those projects, and you ask for support for your projects. So it is a constant kind of negotiation between your role in the academy and the multiple roles you might play in the community, that the more they understand what you need to do to survive, the more useful it is. Because I know when many of our community people come into an institution, they're just like, is this where you work? Mm-hmm. Oh, people aren't very hospitable. They don't serve you food. Mm-hmm. Where's the, they're not nice. Mm-hmm. Why would you choose to work here? And it's this kind of constant sort of tension about what you're doing and why do you choose to work here, why don't you come and work with us, because we'll look after you and we'll feed you up, you'll be much happier, you'll be connected, and then you choose to work here, all those sort of questions about the spaces that we're in, and what we're paid to do, and the extent to which we can prove our worth to our own communities who may have sent us, or in our case, they say we gifted you, and the institution doesn't deserve the gift we gave them. So come home.
A lot of us have not survived because this location, the location from which we stand, and the location to which I was sent, has changed. The locations I've moved since then have disappeared. We're constantly refinding locations, and in that, the three of us are here. We've survived, but there are many of us, close friends, who have not survived the institution and have not survived and are not here with us anymore. They've passed.
Before we break, would you like to give just brief summaries? I think that we discussed it. Just brief summaries of your particular work, and then we'll break and come back to a more of a discussion with the wider circle.
We can try. I don't know how to summarize my work except to say that I think what I've tried to develop in my book is what I call a physics of social love. That is, a way to understand how to make the force we call love into a social dynamic that can enable us as individuals and as collectives to move forward in both creating knowledge and in helping each other to survive.
Well, that's nice and
succinct. Well, I mean, I could go on.
I think one of the worst things about asking us what our work is, it's like, how do you describe how far a rubber band has been stretched? I sort of direct a research institute that's a national institute, and we get money from the government to grow Indigenous research capacity. So I'm moving around the country, do a lot of mentoring and support, and that's supposed to be half my job. And then the other half of my job, I'm supposed to be teaching, and I supervise 12 PhD students in my own institution and PhD students in a couple of other institutions. And then I'm also expected to do service to the university, so I serve on faculty committees and on university committees, and I'm an advisor on national committees. I'm expected to be a national leader. So, I'm working with the Ministry of Education and on sort of major government bodies, and then I'm expected to produce research, and as well as do that, collaborate across institutions, collaborate with graduate students. So I do actually do some research, and you were talking about Aimé Césaire, and there's a line in a poem he wrote about in the wee small hours of the morning. In the wee small hours, I do my research. And so my research is actually in a couple of different areas. One is working with Indigenous scientists trained in the sort of biology and physics, and running some dialogues between them and Indigenous kind of knowledge holders. So looking at the interface between science and Indigenous knowledge. So that's one project. Another project is called Witnessing Remorse, the Public Performance of Remorse. And that's really to do with our treaty settlements and the fact that the Crown comes and, does this big apology to our tribe for to tribes for the grievances that it has perpetrated over 180 years. And then I'm on an HIV/AIDS resiliency project where we're looking at the different ways in which Indigenous communities in Canada, Australia and New Zealand deal with HIV/AIDS and other bloodborne viruses. So those are kind of three projects in which we're trying to use a kind of decolonizing framework to ask different kinds of questions and work with communities, building community capacity, and trying to also produce knowledge and do a little bit of writing from it.
Trying to think about sort of if I could name the impulse behind the work, or at least that written work, what's the impulse behind it, which is I think what you were succinct about, Jayla. I think the impulse behind it is about wholeness. It is about some kind of attempt to sort of figure out our being, not necessarily doing, but being. And some way at this moment of tremendous urgency, when I feel that a lot is at stake, where this time is such a time that's fraught with so much violence,
and so much of a push for us to participate in our own exploitation. And so the question is how to find ways not to participate in our own exploitation from a point of view that's forward-looking. You know, so that you're not perennially against, pushing against something, but moving toward something.
Not always in reaction.
Not always in reaction.
But in an affirmative, but rather in an affirmative movement.
That's right.
That is positive.
That is positive. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's the desire that I want to sort of encapsulate, or that's the desire that I want to live. And a way to live sort of perhaps the whole link to wholeness is about, as I was saying yesterday in our discussion, disappearing the idea of our separation. So how do we disappear the idea of our separation, or the fact that we have forgotten that we are connected?
The damage is so extreme that the first step is toward collaborative, collective engagements where we're doing this kind of work, which I think is important.
Well, thank you. We're going to take a short break for us all to take a breath. Why don't we do, since we're all together, why don't we do this together? If you can sit up in your chair. I'm not going to ask you to sign anything. I'm just going to ask everyone to take a deep breath in together, breathing in and out. Some folks didn't know it was serious, so let's do it again, breathing in and out. Thank you, and we'll come back here at 1 o'clock. Thank you.